Recording in progress. Good morning. Let's see. So,
Professor, I think a lot of us can't hear you.
Hi, Professor. Okay, let's see.
I hear you now.
Okay. Okay, sorry about that. So that is audible now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, all right, sorry. So this is a different sound system. Hopefully it'll stay. All right, anyway, so what I said during all that quiet time was that what we're planning to do today is another example of using the generalized mean value theorem, actually two of them. So one of them that I talked about last time, just introduced but didn't do the proof, which was the Taylor series with Lagrange error. The other thing that I'm going to do is the L'Hopital's rule. So those are two examples where we can use the generalized mean value theorem. All right, so I was just reminding you what the generalized mean value theorem is so that we can use it. All right, so this is a theorem that we already did, and I'm just recalling it. Okay, so again, if we had two differentiable functions, let's call them k and g, at least one time differentiable, and we have some values here between where inside of their domain or definition, then we have a another value in between the c and the x. Let me call it zeta because that's going to agree with the notation that I'm going to want to use in the proof of the second proof we're going to do today. So it's somewhere inside of there. And the property that we had, remember, was this relationship between the slopes coming from the parametric version. That's how it one way to get it. But the formula it turned out to was the difference between values of k, so k evaluated at x minus k evaluated at c, times the derivative of g, and this is at some point in between. Let me call that zeta there. That's supposed to be a zeta, okay? And that's supposed to be equal to what we get if we take k and look at its derivative at that zeta point, and multiply that by the difference, the g of x minus g of c. Okay, so that's the generalized mean value theorem we already saw. Okay, so I wanted to do a couple, as I said, examples of that. So let's try to prove the L'Hopital rule, which is a very handy rule that you're already familiar with, but this is at least a proof of it. So a proof of L'Hopital rule, let me say theorem, and let's see, there are two versions of it. The one that I want to do is the 0/0 version, which is, let's see, 8.54. Okay, so we have the 0/0 L'Hopital rule. And so what does that say? So whenever we have two functions, so for all, let me just use the same names for the moment since I just used k and g over here, I'll use them again. So for all k and g, and once again, they need to have at least one derivative, all right, because we're going to take their derivatives. So these are going to be functions with at least one derivative on some interval AB. Okay, and we have some point inside of AB where we're going to take a limit, all right? So we have, let's say C is between A and B. All right, and then we want to say that the we have some facts about it. So we have that K and G are both equal to zero at our point C. Okay, so this is why we're going to have to take a limit, because we don't know, it's a zero over zero, and that's the idea. But at least we know the limit of the derivatives, and that's why we needed that they're differentiable. So the limit as x approaches c of the derivatives, so k prime of x divided by g prime of x, exists. And let's just give it a name. Let's say it's L. Then, as you know from calculus, this is very handy. It tells us what the limit of the original functions is. And so the limit is that x goes to c of k without any primes divided by g without any primes is the same value, right? So that's the familiar 0 over 0 L'Hopital rule. And now I want to prove it. Okay. So proof. All right, so let's see. So remember what we're going to try to do. We're going to try to use this generalized mean value theorem over here. And actually, we're also going to end up using Rolle's theorem. So if you recall Rolle's theorem, we will need that, which says that if we have two values that are the same, then they're somewhere in between with a derivative of zero. Okay, but we're going to try to use this theorem over here. And so the thing we're going to end up with is this difference here times the derivative equal to a derivative times the difference. So one thing we're going to care about is that difference, and that's easier to deal with. So let's just get that out of the way. Let's compute what those two differences are, and then we can move on. So proof. So I've given you what the k and g are. So note that the difference that we're going to need is going to be k of x minus k of c. And let's see, since we know that k of c is 0, this is just k of x. And similarly, g of x minus g of c is just g of x. So that minus g of c is just g of x. OK? And that, so then the other thing that we're going to need is that the fact that this limit exists. OK? So let's just write out what it means for this limit to exist, OK, in terms of epsilons and deltas. And then we're going to try to get that same fact here for this limit. We'll be done. All right? So let's just try that. So, so we have. For all epsilon greater than zero, right, there exists some delta greater than zero. And whenever we choose an x, which is within a delta of c, then we have that this L here is close to the difference, to the ratio of k at x and g at x. Sorry, k prime at x and g prime at x, as I wrote. And by close, we mean less than epsilon, right? So that's the definition. So that's the definition of the limit being L, and so that it is. All right. OK, and so then we want to get the same thing where we eliminate these primes, right? That's the goal, is get rid of those primes. OK, so let's start. So a couple things to notice. So first of all, in particular, if this number is less than epsilon, then it's a number. Okay. If it's a number, then this is a number. Okay. If this is a number, what can I say about g prime of x?
Not zero.
Right, there's no limit here. This is actually a number. Right? This is a perfectly good number. And so, anyone see?
I wasn't the first to say it, but not it's not equal to zero.
Sadly, I cannot hear people. Odd. All right. But anyway, I imagine someone is saying that it's not zero. All right. Okay. Thanks. Sorry about that. Okay. So. So then we have that g prime is not zero. Okay, and we're also going to need that G is not zero, so let's note that also. So also, G of X is not zero. And let me add a little proof of that, since if for contradiction, if G of X is equal to zero, well, that's the same as G of C. Okay, and so by Rolle's theorem, there's something in between there where the derivative is zero. Then by Rolle's theorem, there exists let me put it over here. There exists some y which is between c and x, so that means that the difference between y and c is less than the difference between x and c, which we know is less than delta, and we have that g prime of y is equal to zero. That's a prime there, g prime of y, but that contradicts what we just finished saying up here. So this contradicts this statement here. Okay, so there's my little side proof that not only is g prime of x not zero, but g of x is also not zero. Okay, so we have both of those facts. Okay, very good. And so then we can just finish up. And so now we can apply the theorem, the advertised theorem over here, this generalized mean value theorem. We're in a position to do that. So let's do that. So and by the generalized mean value theorem, we can find some zeta. See, what does it tell us over here? There's some zeta between C and X. And we have this equation here. So with, okay, well, let's see. We just computed that K of X minus K of C is just a K of X, because this one's zero, right? So we have K of X. And then we have G prime of zeta is equal to a k prime of zeta times, again, the g of c is zero, so we just have g of x over here. All right, so that's what we have. And finally, we know that the g and the g prime are non-zero, so we have that k of x over g of x is equal to k prime of zeta over g of zeta, g prime of zeta, because we can cross divide due to the fact that they're non-zero. And so so we're done. So and since these two things are equal, so we have that the difference between L and the ratio of the K and the G is an example of this K prime and G prime, and so this is less than epsilon. Okay, and this follows from this fact up above. Right, so those are the same value. Yes, that's right. Both G and G prime are non-zero. We had to check both of them. One of them was easier, but we managed to get both of them were non-zero. Okay. Okay. All right. Any other questions about that proof? Which theorem did this prove? So this proved the L'Hopital theorem here. Okay, so we have that whenever we have this x, maybe I'll just summarize what we proved. So, hence, that is, for all epsilon greater than zero, there exists a delta greater than zero. We take the same delta that we did above, the same delta is over here. Okay, and then what we just proved was for all x minus c less than delta, okay, so we plug in this x less than x minus c less than delta, we get this result without the primes. Yeah, which is open-minded. Okay, any other questions about that proof? Okay, so that's one application of this generalized version of the mean value theorem. Okay. All right, so then what I want to do next is go back to the example that I was talking about at the end of last time, which is the other application that we're going to look at for this generalized mean value theorem. Okay, so so back to the Taylor-Lagrange theorem. And as advertised, this is another application of the generalized mean value theorem. Okay. All right. And so let me just recall the picture that we had there. And what it's good for. And then we'll run through the proof, at least a sketch of the proof. So the theorem is as follows. And this is 8.46 in the text, all right? And it says that whenever we have a function f, and this time we need a lot of derivatives. We need n derivatives, so it's got to be in dn, okay, so n times, on some interval ab. And we have two values in between there, so let's do it in this order. It could be, the x and c could be on either side of each other, but it's handy just to choose one for now, okay? So there it is. So then the claim is that there is some zeta in between the middle two, the c and the x. All right, and we're going to try to approximate our function at x using its values at c is what we're trying to do. And zeta is gonna tell us our error. So the theorem is follows. And let me just write it this way. So I have f of x. That's the thing we care about. But we're going to approximate it with this approximating polynomial that I wrote down last time. So this polynomial indexed by its degree, which is n, and the point about which we're expanding, which is c. And then we have a polynomial in x. So that's our polynomial approximation. And the claim is that it's the difference between those two, so the error in our approximation, is given by taking the next derivative, so the n plus first derivative of f, evaluating this value zeta that we just produced or asserted the existence of, and then multiply it by, it's again a polynomial, this time degree n plus 1, so it looks a lot like the next term in our p, so divided by n plus 1 factor. So that's the claim, and this thing we gave a name to, this error, this we called R, and I used a nice collection of subscripts of the degree, the point about which you're expanding, and the point at which you're evaluating. So that was my notation for that difference. Okay? All right, so that's the theorem. Let me run through a couple of examples just so you have them. And we're going to use these a lot, so this is a useful thing to kind of get used to. All right, and so let me just do the two examples I think that I mentioned last time but did not work out anything for. So example, I could take f equals e to the x. That's the cleanest one because, oh, sorry, let me just remind you what p is. I wrote it last time. Let me just write it again just so you have it. So here p sub n comma c of x was equal to, okay, so we started with, we're trying to figure out f at x, we're only going to look at values at c. So we have f of c, and then that's off by something, and so we're going to take f prime at c times x minus c, and then keep going until we get to the nth derivative at c, but here you have to remember that this is actually not just x minus c to the n, but there's a divided by n factorial, and it just happens that one factorial is one, so we didn't see that in the first term. Okay, so that's the formula. Okay, and in particular, that means that we have to figure out what all these derivatives are if we're going to figure out what our function is, and that's really easy over here. So f, all derivatives are the same, they're just e to the x, right? Equals e to the x, right? So that one does not change, so that makes it an easy one to deal with. And in particular, it tells us what the polynomial is. So p sub, let me just write down a specific one. There's no particular reason to do it. I think it's pretty clear it was just a specific one. So let me just tell p sub 3, say, of c and x. Okay, in this case, so I'm just going to look at the degree 3 terms. So there'll be four of them, so there's a degree 0 term too. Okay, so that's going to mean it's supposed to start at f evaluated at c, so that's just going to be e to the c, right? And then our next term, we're going to have the derivative evaluated at c. Well, of course, the derivative didn't change. And then we have this x minus c there, and then we're going to have, again, the second derivative, so again, the e to the c, and then we have x minus c squared over 2, and then we have e to the c x minus c cubed over 6. So I hope that's clear. Any questions about where that comes from? So that's the polynomial approximation. Okay. And so then we could actually see how good an approximation it is. I did a couple of these. Let me just try these. So for example, if I were to, actually I took the next one. I took P4, which you could also compute, 0, and I plugged in minus 1, and this has, I guess, 5 terms, and if you just add them all up, you get some number, and the number you get is 3.375, okay? And the idea is that now the error R for 0 minus 1, so what's that the error in? So I'm supposed to plug minus 1 into my function, so that gives me e to the minus 1, 1 over e, okay? And then I'm supposed to subtract whatever I got from the other one. And so that was 0.375, okay? And what my theorem tells me is that this is between what I get by taking the next derivative, so that's nothing, and then plugging in 0 and c. So it's between minus 1 over, and then I divide by 5 factorial, and you get the sign right. So we end up with a minus 1 over 120, and minus 1 over 120e. Okay, so that's what it tells me, is that my error is off about that much. And in fact, 1 over e is, I guess it's about 0.368. So. Okay, so it's not a bad approximation. So that's the idea. You can use this to approximate these other values. Okay. And actually, you could also compute, I computed another one, so P4, 0, if I go out to, say, 2, then I get 7, and so R, 4, 0, 2 is going to be E squared minus 7, okay, and again, we're going to get some bound between, and it's going to be 4 over 15 and E squared times 4 over 15. So it's not great, but it's not terrible. All right, so it gives us an okay estimate. Okay. So E squared is actually, 7.37. Okay, so those are the types of approximations it gets. Where are the bounds? Okay, thank you. The bounds are the key. So the bounds are these numbers over here. Okay, this is where the bounds come from. So what I'm doing is I'm taking this thing, so that is appearing over here, and I'm plugging in my x and my c and my n plus 1 factorial. That's where this 120 is. This is the n plus 1 factorial, is my 120, all right? And then what I'm doing is I'm taking the n plus first derivative. Well, that's, in this case, that's just e to the x, because all the derivatives are e to the x. And then I'm plugging in the values. And this says that the value that I plug in, this zeta, is between the c and the x. Okay, so my c and my x are minus 1 and 0 here, right, in this case. Those are my c and my x. So this thing is the, I take e to the x, I take its fourth derivative, fifth derivative. Doesn't matter, they're all the same. And then I plug in zero, okay? So that's just one, okay? And then I multiply that by this x minus c. So this is one, so I'm gonna write e to the zero times x minus c, okay? X minus c, that's a minus one. And then divided by 5 factorial, right? That's where that came from. Does that make sense? And then this one is the same thing, except instead of 0 here, I took 1, right? I took the biggest, sorry, minus 1. I took the biggest and smallest values that this could take on. Okay, so that's where those bounds come from. They're copied from this formula. Yeah, I just plug in, and actually, in general, I can't always just plug in the endpoints, but this function is increasing, so the smallest is at one end and the biggest is at the other. Okay, and so you should try this. I let me just note, try this for, f of x equals 1 over x, n equals 4, just like I had here above. This time I can't expand around 0 because I can't plug in 0. So let me take c equals 1. So I'm going to expand around 1. And I can, however, take x equals, say, a half and x equals 3. Those are a good pair to try, okay? You should just try it yourself. Because for one of them, x equals a half, it's a good approximation, so works well. X equals 3 is terrible. Okay, you are approximating a third, and the answer you get is something like 11. So you get 1 over 3 is approximately 11, and your error is like within 32. So the errors just get worse and worse and worse, and you just get a worse and worse estimate. So it's just terrible. And so it works well for some numbers and poorly for others. And that's a phenomenon that is going to come back. Okay. So any questions about how you would do that? Okay. Okay, so that's how you one way to use this is series is to actually approximate values. There, we'll use it for even more later, but that's one thing you can do with it. Okay, if there are no questions about the statement of the theorem, then I'd like to run through a sketch of the proof. Okay, so we're going to try to use our generalized mean value theorem once again. And so I'm going to need my two functions, k and g. The reason I didn't use f, because I've used f in this term, and I want to use the same notation. Okay, so I'm going to choose my two functions. So choose for, and these come out of nowhere, right? So this is a proof that was hard work. You do it backward, and then when you're done, you summarize, and that's what I'm doing. So this is just something you can follow. There's no way you should be able to come up with this. All right, and so I'm going to choose for the generalized mean value theorem two functions. Okay, and the functions are going to be k of t is going to be, and I don't want to use x, right? Why can't I use x? X is up here, right? I don't want to use that. So I need a new variable. So I'm going to call it t is equal to, and I'm going to take it to be this r, my error here, at n, c, and x, okay? Times, and this is the easier of the two functions, is times a polynomial, so x minus t to the n plus 1 divided by x minus c to the n plus 1. Okay, and it's tricky here. What is the variable for this function? And I still can't hear anyone, so but I can see what you type. Yeah, exactly. Someone got it correct. That's right. And I wrote it over here because I really am. It's important. There are all these variables floating around. n isn't really a relative number, but the c, I mean, an integer, but the c and x and t, any one of those kind of looks like a variable. And so, but this is to remind you that that is the thing I'm thinking of as a variable in this function. Okay, and so then I need another one. So if I'm going to use the generalizing value theorem, I need two functions, and the second one is going to be g of t. Okay, and that one is just going to be r n t and x. Okay, so I'm going to take, so what does that mean? So that means I've got this f of x here, and then I'm going to subtract off all of this stuff where I've plugged in a t for a c. So there's a t there, and a t there. T there, okay? So that's what that looks like. Okay. All right, so let's just try computing a few things. I got rid of my mean value theorem, but if you remember, the mean value theorem involves, the generalizing value theorem is gonna involve these differences here, kx minus kc, and then it's gonna involve the derivatives. Right? So those are the things we need to compute. So let's compute those. So let's start over here. So k of x minus k of c. Okay, so let's see. Can anyone see what that is? Yes, that's right. The k of x, if I plug in x in, remember t is my variable, so I'm plugging in x in for t, so this top goes to zero. That's right, so it's only the second term. And the second term, what happens when I plug a c in for t? What happens to this polynomial part? Exactly, that one's just one, so I'm just left with this r part. Okay, so that's exactly what, except for that minus sign. That's exactly what I get. So this is minus RNCX. Okay? Does everyone see that? So I have a zero minus that times one. Okay, so that's the difference. And actually, as long as I'm at it, maybe I'll just finish up over here. So over here, I also need the derivative. So let's compute that. So K prime of T. And remember, T is the variable. So we're differentiating with respect to T. All right, so if I differentiate with respect to t, let's see, what happens to this complicated r here? Exactly. It is a constant. It's got all these c's and x's in it, and then an n, but there are no t's. So this is just a constant, okay? So this one's just a constant. So it just stays r n c x. And also this, this denominator is also just a constant, right? Because it also doesn't have any t's. And so we just have this t here in the numerator, right? And so I can use the chain rule, and I'm gonna get n plus one times a minus one derivative of the inside function times x minus t, and I lost the power of the x minus t, but again, the denominator is just a constant, so nothing changes about the denominator. Okay, so does everyone see that? It looks complicated, but it's not terribly complicated because the only variable is that t, right, up in the numerator. All the rest are just constants. Okay, so that's that one. Now let's try to work with g. G looks simpler, but it's more complicated, right? Because in this case, that t, which appears in all sorts of places up here, right, in R, that's my variable, right? So this one is considerably more complicated than the other one, right? Because t is the variable. All right, and so, but let's try. So what about g of x minus g of c? So let's see, can everyone see that, or should I write it out? So remember that, remember what g is, it's this r, here's r. So we're taking f of x, and then we're taking this polynomial with a t plugged in for the c, right? So we've got this. When I take the difference here, if I just plug in x, right? Then what do I get? So if I plug into this polynomial here, c is equal to x, then what happens? Oops, I left one out, right? This one's also. Yeah, they mostly go to zero except for that one, right? And these two cancel, right? So then we end up with a zero. Because all these other terms go to zero because of this part goes to zero. And this one, I said, that's an f of x, but r is f of x minus this. So we have f of x minus f of x, and so the r part is just zero, okay? So the first one, we're going to get zero again. Maybe I'll write it as f of x minus f of x. Okay, so that's the first one. Okay, and then I'm going to plug in c, and actually, let me just call it plugging in c, because that's what I ended up with over here, and so it's going to be convenient. So I'm just going to write it as r n c x. I'm just going to plug it in formally like that, okay? Okay, and then the most interesting one is the derivative of g. And let me just assert the answer here, and then I'll do one example. So g prime of c, g prime of t. Okay, so let's see. So we're going to start doing this derivative. We can maybe just get started. So remember, this is what g prime of c is, and g prime of t means I plug in a t there. So if I start taking this derivative, what's going to happen to that f of x when I take the derivative? Remember, I'm taking the derivative with respect to t, right? So t is my variable now. So this one is going to go away, right? That's exactly as noted by Neil. This is a constant. Right, so I'm going to go away. This is considerably more complicated, right? Because I have all these t's here. There's a t there, there's a t there, there's a t there, there's a t there, right? All those are t's. So that derivative is going to be complicated. There's a product, so I'm going to have to use my product rule. There's a whole bunch of terms, so I'm going to have to use my addition rule. So I'm going to end up with a mess. But what happens is that a lot of stuff cancels. I'll do one example of that, but that's what happens. And what you're left with is just the part where you take that derivative. That's all that's left. Okay, so let me just write that one down. And so in the end, you're going to get next derivative of this term up here. So that's going to be n plus first derivative evaluated at t here. And then the rest of this is going to be left alone. So we're going to have this x minus t to the n divided by n factorial. So this is my claim is that that's the answer. Okay, let me just do one example of that just so you get some feel. Let me just write this as a claim, because that one takes a little bit of checking. Let me do an example. All right, so let's see, what's a good one? Let me take n equals 2. I think that's enough that you can kind of see what's going on. All right, g prime of t, which is what we're trying to compute, right? So that's going to be, let me just write out what g is. So g is this f of x, right? And then we subtract the p, and so the p has got the f of t in it, right? And then it's got an f prime of t times x minus t in it. And then it's got an f double prime of t times a x minus t over 2 in it. And then we're going to take the derivative of that whole thing, right? So that's what that is. And let's see. So then, of course, as we mentioned, that first term is going to give us a 0. And then we're going to get a minus a f prime of t. Note where these terms are coming from. So the 0 is coming from there, and f prime of t, negative f prime of t is coming from there. And now this is a product rule, so I'm going to get two terms, right? And so this is going to give me two terms. And they're going to be the ones that I advertise, they're going to cancel. So this is a plus. When I take the derivative of that second term, right, there's an inner term which gives me a minus, minus, so I end up with a plus. And so then I have f prime of t times 1. And then I have a minus f double prime of t times x minus t. So you can try it. That's what you get when you use the chain rule, all right? No, sorry, the product rule. And I guess the chain rule comes in too. All right, and so then finally this last term is going to give us also two terms. And as you see, these two cancel. And then these two are going to cancel. And this is all that you're going to do after. So that's how, that's as advertised, how it's going to work. And so, of course, since they cancel, I can just write down what it is because it's going to be the same. So it's going to be a plus f prime of t times x minus t, and then minus this f triple prime of t times the second, the x minus t squared over 2. We're just going to stick to say that. Okay, so that's the answer. Okay, any questions about how that works, at least that this, I hope, is now plausible. I mean, you should still check that that actually works, but it they cancel in pairs. Okay. All right, so once one has that, then everything is straightforward. So now we can, now by the generalized mean value theorem, what do we get? So there exists a zeta, okay, somewhere between C and X. And what we have is that K of X minus K of C times G prime of zeta is equal to K prime of zeta times G of X minus G of C, and I have one too many X's over there, I see. Right, okay. We just computed above that these two are the same. Right? So these cancel and we're left with this, okay? So we'll get G prime of zeta is equal to K prime of zeta. And we just computed what those are, so we can just plug it all in. So, and let's see, where are they? So here's my K prime of zeta here. And here's my G prime. And let's see, so a bunch of stuff cancels, right? So there's these terms cancel, et cetera. I'll just write it out. So we get R NCT times N plus 1. And I'll put the minus one out there. X minus T to the N divided by X minus C to the N plus 1 is equal to whatever we had over here, which is the N plus first derivative evaluated at, so I put in T, it should have been zeta, right? I'm evaluating zeta, let me do that. So, so right here, that T ought to have been a zeta, because that's where I'm evaluating my function, zeta, to the n. Sorry, so now there's not a get rid of the t and replace it with zeta. So this is then n plus 1, f to the n plus 1, n plus 1 derivative evaluated at zeta, and then x minus zeta again to the n over n factor. Just plugging in what we had before, and then we just cancel and whatnot, and we get what we wanted. So we get that this r n c t is equal to, and let's see, the n plus 1 times the n factorial gives us an n plus 1 factorial. The x minus c moves to the to the numerator, and we get the n minus c to the n plus 1. And the n plus first derivative stays where it is, and that's what we wanted. So we're done. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, and see that I am out of time. So next week, it will be limits of functions. And the only thing that you should keep in mind, so far is that you should think about how we were using these p's to approximate the original function f. That's a very good example of using a collection of nice functions, polynomials, to approximate a complicated function. And we're going to talk about in what sense that's a good approximation, and in what sense these approach that as a limit. Because in some ways they do, and in some ways they don't. And this down here is a really good hint as to what kind of stuff goes wrong, because here we're getting a really bad approximation. Right? So in some sense, this one's not doing a good job, and the other one is doing a good job. And that's the distinction we're going to work on next week. Okay, I'm going to stop the recording, and I'll stick around for a while. Of course, I can't hear you, but I can see the chat.